Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, animal control agencies in the Central Valley say budget cuts proposed by Governor Brown would take animal control shelters back to the dark ages, and how you can make a big difference in the future of Fresno County libraries and using research to improve Valley communities. But first, animal control shelters in the Central Valley have some of the highest kill rates in the country, and now a budget-cutting proposal by Governor Brown would make the situation even worse. Here to discuss the issue with us is Beth Caffrey, Director of Community Relations, Central California SPCA, and Maggie Kalar, Marketing and Promotions Associate for Kern County Animal Control. Thank both of you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Now, we are talking, I think, about the Hayden Bill, which was passed originally in the 1990s. And it provides guidelines for animal shelters, including increasing the number of days shelters would hold dogs and cats before euthanizing them. Now, it's my understanding that the governor wants to repeal certain mandates legislated by the passing of the bill, even including reimbursing shelters for the cost of caring for the animals.
Correct. And that's part of what we're really worried about. There's so much that goes into the Hayden Bill that affects all animals that if you take away the whole bill, we're going to lose a lot instead of just suspending portions of it.
And in Kern County?
Well, we've actually been dealing with this a little bit. In 2009, parts of the law were suspended by then-Governor Schwarzenegger. We've continued to give the animals here the best chance at a permanent home by keeping those hold periods the same. But I believe, like Beth says, that any time that you can hold the animals longer and give them more services, you give them the best chance at a second-chance home or being reunited with their owners.
And when it talks about some of the things he wants to do is as far as cutting the cost that you are reimbursed for caring for the animals, what would that mean to the shelter here?
Actually, we haven't been being reimbursed since 2009.
That is correct for us as well.
Okay. Yeah, the whole entire state has been that way. So a lot of animal controls and animal shelters have still been holding under the original Hayden Bill, although they're not getting the funding back for it. So at a huge loss. What would change now is if he takes away the whole entire bill, it wouldn't mandate that they have to have veterinary care for the injured strays. It would change the vaccination protocol for animals entering into an animal center. And it will also change their hold for adoption. So there's a lot of things that go into this bill, and that's why we're really worried about taking away the whole entire thing as opposed to keeping certain portions suspended.
Is there any possibility that that might happen?
Well, we have organizations that are trying desperately right now to work with the governor and in Sacramento to hopefully change just portions of it without taking away all of it.
Now, in Kern County, I think I read, too, like you said, you all have been proactive in continuing some of this. But it seems like I think the past year or whatever, even your kill rate went up. Was it just more animals, budget problems?
Well, it's a combination of things. We're seeing a lot of people suffering from the economy, and unfortunately for a lot of people, one of the first things that they have to deal with is whether or not they can continue to care for their pets that they've had. So we've seen a lot more animals come into the shelter. We have a lot of good people here in the community down here that want to do the right thing, but with the economy the way it is, it's rough to be able to try and provide the proper care that they need for their pets or to decide whether or not they need to put food on the table. And then for those who know that spaying and neutering is so important for their pets, they have to then again deal with the monetary fact of the spay and neuter surgery is very expensive. And so when you're dealing with, you know, down to a one-income family now, they have a lot of these things that they have to deal with. So we do tend to see a lot of animals come into the shelter because of economy-related problems.
Yeah, and notice, too, that was an increase just over, you know, the last year or two.
Mm-hmm.
And so the economy has had an impact. So with so many people losing their homes, then, you know, it's where do they put their pet?
Well,
right,
and
exactly.
And they're moving to find other jobs. So
right,
moving
and that
out of
is
the
a
area.
Big part of it, too.
Wow. So the economy has had a huge impact, you'd say, over the last year or two.
Oh, a very, very big impact.
Definitely.
So how much does it cost to take care of the pets and the animals?
Well, on average, it can vary. But we always tell people to consider the fact that it's going to be, you know, within your budget yearly. Thousands, it could be thousands of dollars, especially if you're going to provide veterinary care.
Right, and that's just the basics. You're talking food and shelter and veterinary care. Then there also comes into play if you need to work with your pet. There might be some behavior issues. There's also training involved with some animals that need that extra bit of a little help. And so all of those things take a toll on your budget, and you have to realize that when you're taking a pet, it's a commitment for life, and a lot of times people realize that fact when they adopt a pet from a shelter or a rescue. But unfortunately, when the economy plays havoc with your budget, that may not always be what you're looking at the end.
But, you know, some people are saying, yes, the economy has had an impact, but the whole issue of people taking responsibility for their dog, I mean, you know, people do this every year. We see, especially during the holidays, they go out and get a cute little puppy, and all of a sudden it's more work than they thought, and it's like so easy for them just to like turn the pet
right
over to the shelter, and it's like, okay, now it's your problem,
right,
and the responsibility really lies on the pet owner. But it's so easy for them to do that.
Well, that's the other part of why this is so very important, is that if we continue to tell the public that animals aren't important, they'll continue to treat them that way. So if we take away this bill, that means that animals are less important than everything else, and especially a proactive approach like spaying and neutering, they won't focus on that. And that's the other big concern with this.
Right, and we agree with that too. The more that you can educate a community about the importance of pets being a commitment for life and not just property that you own, the more they'll take an invested interest in what's going to happen to the animals in that community and do the right thing.
Well, then who's responsible for the education? Because it all comes down to somebody has to do what you're talking about, and that will cost. I mean, there are some, you know, there is at least in the Valley, I think, one no-kill shelter in the Fresno area. And then there's another organization where they provide low-cost spaying and neutering. Just more of this is needed?
No, certainly more of that is needed. What we see in a lot of communities where they actually do see their numbers get reduced, they have a combination of what we have here with a high-volume, low-cost spay-neuter clinic, but they also have mobile spay-neuter units that go out to the public that wouldn't be able to get to a stationary facility. And they also do fund from the front end education along with that spaying and neutering.
What about, I've read too that, excuse me, that there were some issues people, when they started looking at why, number one, the kill rate is so high here in the Central Valley and why we have so many stray animals and why we have so many animals that aren't spayed and neutered, that, you know, some of it is poverty, some of it is people's own personal beliefs about how you treat a pet. Will education help that, or is that just the way people are going to be? I mean, some people will always think, I've heard it time and time again, well, it's just a dog.
Right. Yes, there's certain aspects that we probably won't be able to curb completely. Part of what we have here in the Central Valley is that we have the agricultural dynamic as well. So we have a lot of people that are passing through our area. And again, if we had a more proactive education and mobile spay neuter, then we would be able to go directly to those people right when they're here, when they're bringing in animals, explaining things. And I know that legislation is difficult, but we always liken it to the seatbelt law. Before we had the seatbelt law, a lot of people didn't really want to be told what to do. but it's been huge savings for the state. It's obviously saved many, many lives. And it would be similar if we did something along those lines spay-neuter-wise.
So you're saying basically the laws need to be toughened and you need to mandate that if you're going to have a pet, then you need to spay and neuter it.
Well, the last legislation that we tried for spay-neuter-wise was violation-based. And we think that that would work because, like you said, people that just don't really care about the animals as much or don't feel that there's a problem with letting them roam, those would be the people that we would be able to use that kind of legislation with so that they wouldn't be allowed to do those kinds of things anymore.
Do you think something like that will help?
I do. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is that certainly we want to lead with education. But what we typically see is that education is very, very important, but it's not enough on its own. There were tools that said, you know, please buckle up before we had that as a law, but it changed dramatically once you had both.
Now, specifically, which portions of the Hayden bill that the governor is talking about, and some of it was just cutting funding altogether, what are some of the provisions in that would really hit you hard if their repeal?
Well, we're still, like I said, because we don't agree with taking away that move forward, we're still holding under those guidelines. So as an animal control agency, that portion of us, we would probably always want to hold under that, even though it would hurt us funding-wise. But again, the vaccines and being able to provide veterinary care for the animals that are injured strays, that would be a huge hurt. That would mean there would be no funding for that.
Currently, we do that as well. We vaccinate every animal that enters the shelter upon intake to provide a better chance of prevention of disease control throughout the shelter. We also have a full-time vet and a full-time RVT on our staff, and we've been continuing to provide the medical care and also continue to hold the longer hold times for the animals. And we have no plan at this time to discontinue either of those if the bill is repealed. And it's in the best interest of the animals to provide the medical care and ensure that the animals that come into our care have the opportunity to be reunited with their owners and, if not, go out for adoption or rescue and be as healthy as they can be.
Okay, we'd like to invite our listeners now to weigh in on this issue. I'd like to know what your thoughts are. Do you think that the animal control centers should have that responsibility, or do you think the pet owners should be more responsible when it comes to their animals? Who does that responsibility fall on? You can give us a call at 800-224-8989, 559-275-8989, or you can do it online at kbpr.org. And so we'd like to hear what you have to say about that. But, you know, there was, you know, a column in the paper this morning, I think, and the argument was that the state really can't do it all. You know, if we're looking at cutting the budget and it comes down to whether or not we feed the children and educate, then paying animal shelters to take care of someone else's abandoned pet, then you have to put the other priorities first, and the fact that maybe we just can't do everything.
Well, but this is a health and safety issue for children as well. The bite rate will probably go up. There'll be a lot of things that will affect health and safety if we're not going to take care of the animals, because they affect all walks of life, even though most people don't think that they do. And it will increase the amount of money that it's going to cost taxpayers, especially if they actually care about animals and don't want to see these things happen. And it leaves out huge pockets like incorporated cities that will probably go straight back to the minimum mandate, possibly not vaccinated also, are going to increase disease. So there's a huge amount of considerations that even though, yes, we want to make sure we cover everybody, the animals are always a factor in that.
Okay. I think we have a caller on line two. Hello, your question?
Yes, I am involved in animal rescue in Mariposa County, and primarily dogs and cats. And we've been working with our legislature to try to persuade them to fund spay and neuter. We do spay and neuter clinics, and we get vets to volunteer for us. But if, you know, rabies is very affordable, spays and neuters are unaffordable for most of the population. I mean, it's $125 to spay a female cat, and it goes up there. So if it was there was some sort of legislation involving mandatory spay and neuter, and the vets were forced to provide a low-cost alternative to our citizens, it would greatly help us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for calling. I think that is one of the big questions people have. Spaying and neutering is it's quite a lot. But then other people will say, well, then don't get a pet if you can't afford it.
Right.
You know? I mean, pets do cost money, and I think a lot of people, they start out, you're right, they see a cute little animal and they want it, but I think a lot of people just really don't understand the cost associated to really keep up their animal. I mean, it can be huge, and you also talk about medical cost.
Right, and that's the hugest issue, is that we get a lot of people in that have never seen a veterinarian, and now all of a sudden their animal's been hit by a car. And so you have all those things to consider, and it's really difficult to explain to people why things are so expensive. But when you put things, proactive things in place, like she mentioned, spay and neuter, when if we did something to kind of level the playing field, even a voucher system, it would save so much money in funding all the way across the board and increase health.
That is one of the key issues.
Definitely.
When you talk about vouchering, but still what you're doing, somebody has to pick up the cost, and I think that's where the concern is.
Well, we actually, down here in Kern, we have a program where we take 10% of our licensing fees from our dog licensing fee requirements and put that into a spay and neuter program. Right now it's targeted mainly to the low-income individuals, and they have to qualify for it. It's the first step that we have with our voucher program, and we hope to increase that as we go through and get more responsible pet owners to license their animals to be able to reach out to more populations in the community, not just the low-income, to be able to have a voucher to assist with the cost of spaying and neutering their animals. Because, like we talked about previously, just because you have a job in this economy doesn't necessarily mean that you are able to afford $150, $200 spare neuter surgery for your pet, even though you want to do the right thing. So this is something that we have started the last few years to try and help our community down here.
That's great. That's great. Now, anyone of you know by chance just how much, what the annual cost is for a pet every year? Let's say if we just, what it might cost people to really have, you know, to have an animal, to have a pet, dog or a cat. When you're looking at it, what kind of cost should you expect yearly?
Well, and that cost is hard to put a blanket number on, because you have a huge difference between if you get a puppy or a kitten, or if you're talking about an adult dog. Puppies and kittens need 4 sets of vaccines just within the first 4 months of their lives.
Just like a baby almost.
It's exactly like a baby. And that's the other thing that people need to understand. And then depending on what breed of animal you have, if you have an English bulldog, for example, you're going to have much higher veterinarian costs for that animal because of the skin conditions and different things and that they have health-wise. So it does vary. Like I said, it's going to be several thousand dollars as a minimum, most likely, over the course of just 1 year, because Wow. You're talking about food and everything that goes into it. We do programs that we try to help the citizens, like free training, so you have less of a cost to be able to keep that animal in your home. And there's a lot of things that we can do to help people to lessen what that burden is going to be. But again, there's great information online, probably on every shelter's website, about what it's going to involve when you do bring an animal home. So please make sure that you do your homework before you bring an animal in, because it should be a lifetime commitment.
Exactly. What are some of the services each year, we'll talk here in Fresno and then Kern County, services do you offer? I mean, I know you have education classes and programs, but what are some of the other things you do?
We do. We go out to schools. We have free programs that we offer for education, especially dog bite safety. We also have what we call Spay Fresno, which is a fund for people that can't afford to spay and neuter their animals. It's a $20 copay. And we do, it is currently targeted at lower income, but we do work with people so they can get their animals spayed and neutered. We provide all animal control for all of Fresno County and Fresno City. We take animals in from incorporated cities. as well. We have a low-cost vaccine clinic at our hospital on our grounds. We do foster care. We have many, many services that we do to try and help the community. But it, particularly Spay Fresno is targeted at those that when they walk in with a litter, we want to try and find out if they're willing to spay and neuter the parents so that we don't have that continue.
Okay. In Kern County?
Well, we actually have a lot of similar services that they're up there in Fresno. We do also have free educational presentations to the schools and to other community organizations so that if a group or a club is meeting and they want to find out more information about what animal control is, how they can help in their community, we'll go out and provide a presentation and encourage them to come in and volunteer. We also have, which I did mention, which is our spay-neuter vouchers. It's the same thing. It's very similar. It's a $20 copay, and then it goes ahead and takes care of all of the spay-neuter costs for the individual, and it is geared, again, towards the low income at this time. We also provide animal control services for the unincorporated areas of our county. We also have foster care available. We have a volunteer program here. And then recently we were awarded a huge grant from PetSmart Charities. We've termed it our Happy Kern Cats Grant. And what it is basically allowing individuals in the 93306 area code where we are down here to bring in their cats and have them, their feral or free roaming cats in the area, to be fixed and released back into the area. It's like a trap neuter return program so that we can start to try and manage some of the overpopulation problems that we're seeing in our community. We also provide disaster preparedness training for different agencies. We work closely with them as well as partnering with other agencies to run drills because we are so prone to fires and the like down here in this area, especially during certain times of the year.
Well, you know, despite you all have listed all the wonderful things that you do, but even despite that, you really come under attack from a lot of animal advocate groups that just believe that you're not doing enough at all at this point, and the fact that the kill rates here in the Valley are so high. Why is it that the kill rates in a place like Fresno County would be so much higher than it is in a large city?
Well, first of all, a lot of us have been misrepresented on what our actual euthanasia rates are. Mm-hmm. We provide humane euthanasia, especially for animals that have extreme reasons to be euthanized. And that's a different number versus an adoptable animal that gets euthanized. We do have a high rate of animals that get euthanized that are adoptable, but it's not as high as what people put out in the media. What needs to happen is that we need to be able to have everyone understand our numbers better, because then it reflects the animals that they're actually talking about instead of kind of a words battle. And with the economy, people can adopt. It's expensive to adopt, to be able to provide all the services that we provide. We keep lowering our rates, but that's got to be funded somehow else as well.
Yeah.
Because if you don't do business well, then you're going to run out of money and we wouldn't be able to serve any animals. So the biggest thing is that for people to actually learn more about what's really happening, what those true numbers really are, and then the reproduction has to stop. The only areas that you see where you have lower euthanasia of adoptable pets is where they've been very proactive with spaying and neutering.
Yeah. And you do have a lot of that. You just, you know, people who don't spay and neuter, and then their dog or cat has, you know, more babies that are just kind of oftentimes are just left out there.
Right.
Well, it's definitely a cycle. And you can definitely see that continuing to happen when you hit those warmer months, especially right now. We're starting to see an increase already in cats and kittens starting to come into the shelter because it's that time of year when what we call kitten season, basically. And what's going to happen is if people aren't educated or given the opportunity to be able to find programs that can work within their budget, this is going to continue to happen. One of the things that we've tried to combine with the recent program, we have what we call a PEAT program, which is our public education and enforcement team. And what they do is they go out and they canvass door-to-door with individuals that have dogs in certain neighborhoods, and they leave a packet of information. They counsel them in the importance of getting their pet vaccinated and licensed, and then also provide them with information on where they can go to get spay and neuter assistance, whether it's low income or no income requirements in the community, because we feel this is such an important thing for our community to be able to come into the 21st century and realize that spaying and neutering is one of the best ways we can reduce the pet overpopulation in our community here.
Okay. So as we get ready to sort of wrap this up, we look at where you are now, and then if the governor goes ahead and makes those budget cuts, what can you expect for the future, and what's going to have to happen?
Well, we, like I said, as an individual agency, we would probably not want to go back to a minimum statement mandate of the 72 hours along with all the other things. But it's going to be a huge difference in how we can get funding, what we can do with the funding that we have. So it's going to take a lot of creativity to be able to continue to help the animals the way we need to help them. And it would be wonderful if we would look at things like states like New Hampshire that, again, does what Kern's doing with their licensing. A portion of it goes right back into spaying and neutering. So I think that all the animal advocates are going to have to work very, very hard, even though they already are, to come up with creative ways to change things again. But we are pleading with the governor not to take the Hayden bill away completely, just portions of it.
Okay.
Down here in Kern, we're going to continue to do what's in the best interest for the animals, and that means no matter what happens in Sacramento, we will continue to keep our hold periods as long as possible. We'll continue to provide the medical care that the animals need. We're going to continue to look for grants and find ways to continue to educate our public down here about the importance of being a responsible pet owner and spaying and neutering those pets.
Okay. Thank you both very much for joining us this morning for this discussion, important discussion, especially for people who love animals. And one of the things that we didn't mention is that it's not just dog and cats. You know, you all get other kinds of pets as well that you end up having to care for.
Oh, it's horses, too, for us. We have 30 right now.
Wow.
We've been through that route. We had approximately in the past 6 months, we've had almost 40 horses come through our shelter here, too, as well.
Wow. Okay. Huge responsibility. Again, Beth Caffrey and Maggie Kalar, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. In 1998, voters approved Measure B, a 1/8 of 1% sales tax to go to Fresno County Libraries. Voters approved it again in 2004, and friends of the Fresno County Public Library are asking voters to support the measure again, as it is set to expire in March of 2013. Here to tell us why is Karen, is it Boschkop? Okay, Citizens for Libraries for Literacy. And we also have Laurel Prizzi. She is a Fresno County librarian. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I read that the money for Measure B is responsible for 53% of the library's budget. Now, that is a lot of money. That's a huge part of your budget. Now, if you lost that, what would that mean?
Oh, dear. Well, it would be obviously devastating in many ways. 53% of our budget really means 53% of our services. So we would be having to look at potentially closing facilities, reducing hours significantly, buying much, much less materials, and dropping or eliminating programs and services. And it would take us back to service levels that would actually be worse than what they were prior to the instigation of Measure B back in 1998.
And this is Karen, and I could add that I was working in the library prior to 1998, and I remember how poor the library services were at that time because we had terribly reduced hours, and the citizens were very confused because they couldn't figure out when their library was open.
Yeah, I remember that as well. I'm a big library user. So let's take a look at that, and because I think I saw some place too where you listed what you're able to do with the extra funds. You compare to where you were before the money and what you were able to provide and what it would mean if that money was reduced as far as hours, the library stayed open, resources, all of that sort of thing.
Well, we're still working on those contingency plans in the event that the renewal, the bid to renew Measure B doesn't pass. And, you know, we're hoping that that won't be the case. But, you know, really, it's a little early to tell what it will mean in total. But, I mean, essentially what I said, it will be, you know, we won't be able to buy e-books, for example, which is one of the newest and hottest technologies. And, you know, we're installing Wi-Fi in several of our libraries, and that's something we would have to stop. Other programs and services would be affected, certainly the services to our seniors and our Talking Book Library for the Blind, for example, would also be affected. So there's several programs that we're offering now that we would have to dial back or simply cease to offer at all.
And I could add that when Measure B passed in 1998, we were able to double our open hours for the public, which was just a tremendous thing. And we tripled the amount of money that we were spending on the materials that we were buying, books and all those kinds of things, and greatly increased our programs. And the public responded so well to those things. I think that the number of books being checked out right now is about four times prior to what it was in 1998.
Yeah, we circulate almost 4 million items a year right now.
Wow. Well, you know, sometimes people might think, you know, with today's technology, libraries wouldn't be as busy as they are. Now, I have been to them, and they are packed. There are nights, you know, especially after school, yes. People coming in using the computers. You know, why do you think they are? They really seem to be busier than ever. Is it because you just added more services and this kind of services people really want? But for a lot of people, that's, you know, not everybody has a computer.
Well, and I think you just spoke to part of it. I mean, the library is many things. We are a community center where people want to come and meet. Teens want to socialize there. We have, you know, book clubs that come and meet. But we've got tutoring going on in the libraries. We've got all kinds of programs that are happening. So we're definitely a community center in each of the areas where we have a library. But we're more than that. We're also a place where people come to do job searching, to get skills for computer use, computer training. We've got a job skill center at the Gillis Branch Library. You know, in tough economic times, libraries actually fill a void. We provide free internet access. We've got people who actually have their own computer, but they'll come in and use the library's Wi-Fi network in the libraries that we've got Wi-Fi, or they may even come in and use our high-speed network with our own computers because they can't necessarily afford the connection because maybe they've been laid off and they're out of work. And so we tend to level the playing field. We provide those resources for anyone that wants them.
Also, you were able to extend hours, and didn't you open some new libraries out to some of the rural areas?
Yes, we've been really fortunate. This year we opened the Tranquility Branch Library out in Tranquility. We've also opened a new facility since Measure B, several actually, Mendota, Orange Cove, Fowler. Karen, you probably know more than I.
Woodward opened. And
oh, yeah, Woodward,
we moved
yeah.
into a number of much better rented facilities. The Sunnyside mm-hmm. Library was a recipient of a larger facility.
West Fresno.
And if you are a library lover, or if you have a comment about our libraries and would like to know more about Measure B, please give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at kvpr.org. Now let's talk a little bit about Measure B and what it does and what it provides. Now, it's 1/8 of 1%.
Yes. So that would be equivalent to 12 cents on $100. It's a very, very small
amount
of money.
Those pennies rolling around in the bottom of your purse,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the ones that you're picking up and throwing on the dresser.
And I think because Measure B has been around for so long that people just may not think about it. You know, it's just part of, you know, it's just part of their everyday habits. They don't think about the fact that, oh, I'm paying a extra sales tax for these, because we're really getting a bang for the buck, it seems.
Right. It's a small amount of money for everyone. And I should also point out that there's no sales tax charged on food. So it's really just on things that are, you know, really less important than the things that we need to survive every day.
So what role, when it comes to Friends of the Libraries, when it comes to trying to inform people about Measure B, and what do you think it's going to take as far as an effort to get it passed again?
Actually, there's a citizens committee that's been formed that's working on the sales tax measure, and we've been working closely with the Friends of the Library. But the citizens group has been working for about a year now to get things started, with a big effort on all the things that have to go on before you even launch a campaign. So we're really in very good shape. And we're just about ready to launch our fundraising effort, and also to look for endorsements and support of people. One of the things that we'd like to invite people to do is to ask us to email if they're interested in working with us. And I have an email address that I could give you. It's librarymeasureb@gmail.com. librarymeasureb@gmail.com. Really easy to remember, and we would just love to hear you. All of our past campaigns have been very much grassroots efforts, and that's what makes a difference. A person tells their story about how the library's made a difference in their life to their neighbor or their friend, and reminds them of why the library is so important in our community.
Especially in the rural areas, I would say.
I think it's important for
everywhere.
Everywhere, for no matter where you live, people use the library.
Now, what do people need to do? Because sometimes we just we really take sometimes the services that we have for granted until we're kind of made aware of what the situation really is. So, I really think part of what you're talking about is your campaign is just going to be you have to kind of make people more aware of the services of the libraries, but really having them take a look at what to lose 53% of your budget, what that would look like.
Mm-hmm.
What would that look like?
I think that one of the things that the library is engaged in this year, as we gear up for the measure and in working with the citizens, the library is trying to launch more of an educational campaign, just to have people understand a little bit more about what the library is all about and the role that we play in people's lives. We know the people who come in value us very highly, and we have been telling their stories for a while, and we're trying to do more of that. And I think from the library's perspective, it's simply a matter of education and letting people know that for 12 cents on $100 of purchases, you really are getting extremely good value for that expenditure, and just having people understand that.
And then from the campaign's point of view, of course, we'll have lots of big public effort. Whether or not we can afford a lot of television and radio is really going to be dependent upon how much money we can raise. But we hope to go to all the city councils and many organizations. And so we truly need that army of volunteers is what we need now. I'd like to have about 3,000 people working for us. Seriously.
A lot of times that's what you do. You just have to get out and pound the pavement.
Yeah, and we have a big county, and there's a lot of pavement and a lot of rural roads to pound.
Now, when does this issue come before voters?
It's on the ballot for November 6th, and so people.
So it would be this year.
It's going to be this year, and it has to be this year. And of course, it has to pass. Or beginning March or beginning April 1st, Laurel's going to have to make some really drastic reductions in services.
Right.
Yes.
But the thing about, I guess you could say, being on the ballot in November, it's going to be a huge election in November, so you people are expecting a good voter turnout at least. You would have that.
They are, and this is going to be at the end of a very long ballot. It's a local measure, and that's where local things go. But I think it's the most important thing on the ballot. People need to go to the end of the ballot, vote yes first, and they can go back and fill out the the rest of the ballot.
Well, I guess when you think about it, you know, as a local resident, you know, and when you if you look at the libraries as part of your community, then this is something where you can have an impact.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the money all stays locally in our community. We're truly voting on the quality of life in our own county.
Well, I can remember myself before Measure B that the county and the libraries were really looking at some major, major cuts when it came to the libraries, and your hours had already been cut back.
Right, right. We went through a series of reductions in the 80s and the 90s, and you know, it was just one thing after another, and just kept getting worse and worse, and you know, it was very hard for people to find the things that they needed at the library, or even to find their libraries open.
Yeah, but now when you go in, they really provide some great services. Like I said, I've spent a lot of time there myself. So you all are gearing up for your campaign right now as far as trying to get this measure passed. Correct?
That's right. We've got a citizens group that's been meeting for about a year, and we have all kinds of things in place, and including just about being ready to sign a contract with a consultant. So what we need people to do at this point is just to send me an email at that address, the email address that I gave you, and sign up to do some work. And it can be very simple, you know, giving us the name, sending us some money, offering to put a yard sign up. But we need all kinds of people to do all kinds of work.
And I know you have your groups outside, the Friends of the Library and the Citizens, but the libraries themselves, what role can they play in this?
Well, the library certainly will provide information and advice in terms of, you know, resources and materials. We can certainly tell the customers what Measure B is all about in terms of, you know, what it funds and the impact that it's had on library services. And we're certainly prepared to provide that role. The advocacy side, though, does stay on the Citizens Committee and the Friends. The library staff can certainly get involved on their own time. And if people come in and ask, we'll provide all kinds of information on how we're run and how we're funded. And then the staff will get involved on their own.
Now, do you all have any projects in the works right now that would be impacted if Measure B didn't pass?
You mean in the library? Oh, absolutely. You know, we are in the process of trying to implement our self-check system, which allows people to check materials out on their own. And we're trying to do that system-wide. So it's not a cheap venture, and it actually allows us to better utilize our staff in other areas rather than having them sign out materials. And so that's something that would definitely be put on hold. We also are trying to do some renovations in facilities. Last year, for example, we were able to re-carpet Clovis and fix the lighting in that facility, and that's the kind of thing that would be put on hold for other facilities. And that's a commitment that was put in with Measure B. Measure B promised more hours, more books, and in sustained and improved or brand new facilities. And so those are things that would definitely be put on hold. And the introduction of new technologies. Libraries are always a good place to start and try new technologies. You know, we went from the long playing record all the way through to the CD now, and even e downloads, audiobook downloads, and now of course the e-books. So all of those things would be put on hold if there was a problem with Measure B.
And how many, when we look at the branches, how many branches do we have now, and have they increased?
Okay, we've got 34 currently, plus
wow,
two bookmobiles. And now, Karen, when we had Measure B, before Measure B, it was 27, am I right?
No, boy, I think it's closer to 32. And I know we had two bookmobiles, not three bookmobiles.
Okay. Okay. So we've changed, and you know, and what's happened in some instances, like Orange Cove is a good example, where the Orange Cove Library existed before, but with Measure B and state funding, we were able to build a brand new facility there and close the old facility. So there's been a lot of that kind of renovation or replacement, such as, again, the Tranquility facility, which just opened last summer and replaced a building that the library had been in for over 80 years. It was just a small, teeny, teeny one-room library, and now they've got this gorgeous 3,400-square-foot facility instead.
Wow. And that was true in so many other places in Mendota and Orange Cove and Fowler, you know, had buildings that we rented buildings that we'd been in for, you know, 50 years. And oh my gosh, what a change.
Yeah. Well, okay. Thank you both for coming in to talk about Measure B and just to let us know just the importance of our libraries. Karen Boschkopf, Citizens for Libraries and Literacy. And Laurel Prisney, Fresno County Librarian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. An innovative community-university partnership to empower San Joaquin Valley residents to analyze and communicate their most pressing challenges launches, I think, today in Fresno. Here to talk about it is Jonathan London with UC Davis and Mr. Isao Fujimoto, also with UC Davis. Now, this whole project, it all has to do with, you know, kind of empowering the residents to kind of take control of their area. If you live in an area and you're concerned about something and you want to make some changes, if you can get together and go out and do the research and present it, that kind of gives you the, you know, the information and the power you need to go about making changes.
Absolutely. And the term that you used, two terms you used there of research and power really highlight the purpose of the center. It really is to provide training and research methods for grassroots and other community organizations to build power, you know, power to understand what's happening in their communities, to be able to describe that in compelling ways to policymakers and others, and then to mobilize themselves together to take action.
Now, what role will both of you play in this whole partnership?
As a professor at UC Davis, I'll be working with colleagues such as Isao Fujimoto, who's an emeritus professor there. And I think there's a little difficulty with his hearing aid and the setup. So I'll describe a little bit of our role.
But you can go and jump right in. Is it professor?
Yeah.
Okay. Professor, and just joining the conversation, just a little technical information. These are just for you to, you know, to hear what our technicians are saying. So as long as you can hear me, we're fine. Okay. They don't need that to hear you. Okay.
Got it. There'll be colleagues at UC Merced and UC Davis, as well as places like UC Berkeley, UC Santa Cruz, and others, who will be able to provide training in research methods, to be able to bring our students to participate with communities, and to really be in partnership with community organizations to really hear what they need and the kinds of questions or challenges they have, and then to find the resources both at the university and even outside the university that can be, you know, that can be useful for communities to tell their story.
That's great. That's great. And I think one of the organizations you're going to be working with is the San Joaquin Valley Latino Environmental Advancement Project. Mm-hmm. And one of the big problems we have here, we have neighborhoods, you know, where there's higher pollution levels, people who might live near, you know, a dump or something like that. And they, what we're looking at is you would help them go out and do the research to show how that might be impacting their community. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. So Ray Leon's organization, SJV LEAPS, is one of a number of groups that's playing an active role. Ray's group really playing a leadership role. But environmental justice organizations that have been struggling for generations and communities struggling for generations to both have the again, the information they need to be able to describe what's really going on in their communities, to petition government to really pay attention to that, and so that research can play one role. It's certainly not the only part. There's all kinds of grassroots organizing and power building that's needed, but this piece can help communities deal with air quality issues or water quality issues, the things that are important to them.
Now, you two, are you both based here?
No, we're both in Davis. I think the important thing we're talking about here is how can universities and community people work together? Because traditionally, research at universities is seen as pretty esoteric, and community people can't understand it. And vice versa, community people want answers to problems that they're facing, but there's a tendency for these two groups to be far apart. And so it's very important to develop a common language and identification of problems that both could work on. And this is what this effort is about. I think that's a very important thing, is how can groups, both the university and community people, work together?
And you're right about that, because the both of them, like UC Davis, they do a lot of research concerning the Valley already, and now we have UC Merced. It's like, why not take advantage of both of those?
Yeah, I think that you've said it right on, and certainly thinking about Fresno State University and Fresno City College and other entities, that we've got tremendous resources, and we just need to be able to
tremendous resources, but we also have tremendous problems. We have some
yes.
huge issues here in the Valley.
Correct.
So when you think about you look at having the opportunity to access the researchers at UC Davis and UC Merced, that's great. That's very important to be able to tap into that. Now, will you be coming to, how will that work? Will both of you be coming in, spending time with the groups and helping them with their research, or how will that all work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll be here, and also, as I say, trying to bring other students and other area experts, depending on the issues that are of interest to the community. We'll try to play that organizing role on campus to bring those people here and to do training with groups like Ray Leon's, as well as other community organizations. So those will be trainings that'll happen at this new participatory Action Research Center and downtown Fresno, but also would be trainings that could be happening out in the communities themselves.
So the Research Resource Center is going to be located in downtown Fresno.
Yeah, and maybe I'll ask Ray Leon.
Ray is here. Tell us about your involvement in this whole project.
I don't know if the Courage was mentioned.
Earlier. I didn't mention it by name, so please.
Probably about 6 years ago, university and community leaders came together and began discussions or conversations around community needs and university academician resources. And so we began building a group, a coalition, university community coalition called Community University Research for Action and Justice. And so that really is a seed that has led up to this flower, which is a PAR resource center. And from the get-go, really the notion was about how do we bridge the resources from the university to the communities, especially those within this region of the San Joaquin Valley, which we know a variety of issues exist, and education is definitely one of those issues. So how do we really open it up so that the university is not only one that could help communities resolve, identify, and create change in their communities, but also I think the whole process of doing that and exposing families and children learning of the university, then you really free more birds with one effort.
Well, right, you're exposing young people to the university and higher education at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then you also think about the fact that this could be a learning tool. You could start introducing young people to research early on.
Exactly. And I think one of the, you know, there's a, the rates of higher education in the Valley are very low.
Very low.
And of course, the nature of it being an agricultural industry and an immigrant. My parents went up to third grade, but I mean, they've been really successful. And there's a lot of other parents out there that have not graduated from high school, perhaps. But this is, I think, a popular education opportunity to build up critical thinking skills and critical democracy building elements that will improve all of society in our region.
So what are some of the first issues you're going to tackle?
Definitely environmental justice. Valley LEAP, Latino Environmental Advancement Project, which is the organization I founded 4 years ago on leap year. And this leap year will be our fourth annual anniversary. And we are working with families in a variety of communities in Fresno and Kings counties on environmental justice. We have a group of mostly moms called Promotoras Verdes, green promoters, environmental health promoters. And we definitely see them being a part of this. We also are working with youth, a youth participatory action research in the low area, the low community, one of the most disenfranchised communities in the city of Fresno, and we see huge opportunities with its resource center to really strengthen social justice infrastructure.
Okay. With this resource center going to be located downtown, will the students be able to come in? Is that your goal, to have students and people from the community be able to access all of this?
That and us going out. I think us going out is probably going to be the stronger portion to begin with, but I think Isao could really speak to that because he's got the history. And he's one of our elders in this, and he could really share a lot more in that respect.
Okay. Isao?
Well, I think what I want to stress is that the term research is often identified with people with a lot of education. And what we're breaking down here is that anybody can do research. In other words, people with questions that need answers, they could be taught how to find. And we find that students, community citizens, are just as capable of doing good research. And the university's role here is to help teach people how to do the work. But we feel that the community people have very legitimate concerns, and it's very important that we listen to what they're concerned about and to find out the causes of the problem. And the most important thing here about the joint effort is that not just to find information, but to start asking, what do we do with it? How do you start working on finding the solutions to the answers that we found? So this is the important effort behind this particular effort.
Well, I think that's absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. Not only that, I think being able to access and be in partnership with two fine universities, I think is absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. For people here in the Valley and the Fresno County region. So I'd like to thank all of you for joining us this morning for this topic. I'm really looking forward to once you get going and have you come back and talk about some of your findings. It sounds wonderful and great to me, and thank you all for being here this morning.
And
thank
if you could go with us on the road, too.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind that.
And we'll have this opening today at 3 o'clock.
That is right. It launches today, February 14th, Valentine's Day, and where?
At 2502 Merced Street, corner of O Street, just down the way from the water tower.
Okay, right downtown.
Right.
Okay, thank you all. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.